This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Wishes Won't Bring Riches by Napoleon Hill. Read for you by Joe Aukman and Christopher Grove. Your other self comes to your aid only through the power of your faith. Forward by Don M. Green, Executive Director, the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Napoleon Hill wrote 17 booklets in 1941, each one explaining one of the principles of success he had first learned from Andrew Carnegie when he interviewed him in 1908. Napoleon was a young magazine reporter at the time, assigned to interview Mr. Carnegie, and Mr. Carnegie was so impressed with him that he commissioned him to research and write a philosophy of personal achievement. Napoleon spent the next 20 years meeting with successful men, and he wrote what he learned in the classic 1928 book, Law of Success. In 1937, he wrote a condensed version, which he titled Think and Grow Rich. The 1941 booklets were titled Mental Dynamite, which was a phrase used by Andrew Carnegie to describe the 17 principles of success. Each booklet contained lengthy excerpts from Napoleon's interview with Mr. Carnegie and an analysis of the featured principle by Napoleon. Within months of their publication, the United States entered World War II, and the booklets were set aside by an understandably preoccupied nation. The Napoleon Hill Foundation has now retrieved them from its archives and is publishing them for a new generation of readers. In this book, the Foundation has assembled three of Dr. Hill's booklets explaining how actions can be used to achieve objectives once a definite major purpose has been selected and a plan conceived to achieve it. These chapters therefore begin once the thought process has been successfully concluded. As Napoleon states in Chapter 3, plan your work and work your plan. This book starts after the plan has been made and concentrates on how to work it. In Chapter 1, Applied Faith, Napoleon begins by setting forth that portion of his 1908 interview with Andrew Carnegie, focusing on this principle. Mr. Carnegie tells young Napoleon that he needs applied faith in order to carry out his 20-year assignment of preparing a philosophy of success. He explains the differences between blind faith, passive faith, and active faith. Mr. Carnegie identifies the capabilities of the mind in an almost poetic fashion, then explains to Napoleon that these capabilities cannot be obtained until fears and self-imposed limitations are replaced by applied faith. Action, persistence, and repetition are required to develop such faith. And once it is developed, it permits infinite intelligence to take control and achieve the objects of one's plans. After recounting his interview with Mr. Carnegie, Dr. Hill provides two personal stories illustrating how he used applied faith to achieve success. The first recounts that he lost all his money when the banks failed during the Great Depression. But he came to understand that the workings of nature and infinite intelligence were more important than money, and this discovery produced in him the applied faith he needed to persevere. The second recounts the amazing story of his son Blair, born without ears, who, thanks to the applied faith of Napoleon, gained the ability to hear in the absence of any of the physical instruments of hearing. Dr. Hill then discusses the importance of the ego in attaining success and points out how it must be controlled. As Mr. Carnegie had said, fear and doubt must be replaced with faith for the ego to attain its desires. Dr. Hill provides examples of men who controlled their own egos and of men whose egos were controlled by their wives. But in all cases, this control was essential to their success. Dr. Hill sums up the importance of applied faith by stating that it is the most powerful law of nature, because it permits one to acquire the physical counterpart to one's desires. Chapter 2, Enthusiasm, also begins with excerpts from Napoleon's interview with Andrew Carnegie in 1908. Mr. Carnegie states that enthusiasm is necessary to clear the mind of negative elements so that faith may take their place. It is an expression of hope which is needed to develop faith, and hope, faith, and enthusiasm are all essential to attaining success. Mr. Carnegie details the many impediments to developing and maintaining enthusiasm, such as poor health and use of alcohol or narcotics. He explains how young Napoleon's upbringing in poverty carried with it the seed of an equivalent benefit, namely the enthusiasm that Napoleon's stepmother instilled in him, which motivated him to become a magazine reporter. Mr. Carnegie speaks about how enthusiasm, as well as lack thereof, is contagious and can spread throughout a business, institution, or family. It is equivalent to a positive mental attitude, but it must be controlled by self-discipline, or it can be misdirected. Every mastermind alliance must have members who are enthusiastic, but also at least one who is not, to balance out and control the enthusiasm. In the final analysis, enthusiasm, just like applied faith, is necessary to move beyond the thinking phase and act to carry out one's major plan based on a definite major purpose. Following his presentation of his interview of Mr. Carnegie, Dr. Hill elaborates on what he learned. He states that enthusiasm is faith in action and the action factor of thought, and that it can change a negative attitude to a positive one. He explains how a balanced and harmonious mind is needed to develop enthusiasm. He lists many of the positive things that enthusiasm can accomplish, most importantly, converting positive emotions to negative ones and preparing the mind for the development of faith. Dr. Hill emphasizes the importance of being an effective speaker, because speech is the principal way one exhibits enthusiasm. He then sets forth a long interview he had with inventor Thomas Edison, demonstrating how Mr. Edison's enthusiasm for his work drove him to discover the talking machine and electric light bulb. Dr. Hill also provides a helpful list of the steps one needs to take to develop enthusiasm. He concludes the chapter with a hopeful look at the future of America and the world, based in major part on his belief that enthusiasm will prevail. The third action chapter selected by our foundation is the principle Dr. Hill refers to as organized individual endeavor. It, too, begins with excerpts from the Andrew Carnegie interview. Mr. Carnegie describes 31 characteristics of leadership and emphasizes the need to take action quickly and not procrastinate. Organized individual endeavor requires a purpose, a plan, continuous action, and persistence. A strong desire to achieve is more important than book learning. One need not be a genius to succeed. Mr. Carnegie concludes the interview by telling Napoleon that Napoleon and the world will gain material wealth but also spiritual understanding from Napoleon's writing of the philosophy of personal achievement. Material wealth alone is destructive of character and must be accompanied by spiritual growth and enlightenment. Dr. Hill follows the interview excerpts with an analysis of organized individual endeavor. Only 2% of the people succeed, and this is due to one or more of 40 human faults that are the enemies of organized individual endeavor. He lists a number of successful men who followed this principle and states that it is the master of defeatism. He tells the story of two men who succeeded by using organized individual endeavor. One was well-educated, the other was not, but they both exploited the strengths they possessed. Dr. Hill emphasizes the importance of taking inventory of one's strengths, then using them to achieve one's goals. He states that you need to plan your work and work your plan. The three principles explained in this book teach you how to convert your plans into action. Thinking, hoping, and dreaming are not enough. You must act to achieve your goals. As Napoleon Hill states, wishes won't bring riches.
Introduction to Chapter 1. Because of the profoundness of the subject of this chapter, it seems appropriate to approach it with a prepared mind. Therefore, I take the liberty of offering this brief introductory analysis of applied faith. First, let us take notice of the word applied. The purpose of the author in using this word is to draw a clear line of distinction between the word faith, as it is generally interpreted, and the words applied faith, as interpreted in this chapter. Most people use the word faith carelessly, and many misuse it where the word confidence would more nearly describe their meaning. Many others speak of faith without any attempt to apply it in connection with their aims and purposes. The purpose of this chapter is that of describing the exact meaning of faith, with suggestions for its application in the solution of the daily problems of modern life. The chapter deals with the active, motivating faith that is put into daily practice, not the theory of passive faith. There is a definite and dependable method by which that state of mind called faith can be attained. The burden of this chapter is to describe this method in terms that are clear and understandable. The chapter does not approach the subject of faith from the viewpoint of theology, this field being left entirely to men who have prepared themselves for it. This explanation is offered to forestall the conclusion on the part of any student of this philosophy that this or any other chapter of this book is intended to influence anyone's religious belief. The only religion with which this philosophy is intended to deal is the broad, general religion of right thinking and right living in connection with the important problems of human relationship in the practical affairs of life. Let me emphasize here and now the fact that I have no misconception as to the final source of faith, regardless of any specific application of this power I may suggest. While it may be largely superfluous of me to describe my conception of the source of faith, I nevertheless take the liberty of saying that it is my belief that no one may ever reach the state of mind we call faith without a definite belief in a supreme creator. Whenever I use the term infinite intelligence, let it be clearly understood, therefore, that I have reference to that universal power through which the Creator gives life to every living thing, from the smallest blade of grass to his greatest handiwork, man. My conception of the term infinite intelligence is this. It is the extended shadow, so to speak, of the divine Creator. The term, as it is used throughout this chapter, has reference to that portion of the divine mind which we can recognize and understand as it is manifested through all natural laws by which all manner of life on earth is controlled. Here I am dealing only with such forces and tangible realities as can be explained in connection with the practical problems of life, and it is my purpose to make no claims which are not based solidly upon the known experiences of men who have achieved noteworthy success through the application of this philosophy. It is my hope that no reader will undertake to assign meanings to my words which I have not intended. The subject of this chapter is one that should interest the whole of civilization at this time, because it is the consensus of opinion among men who have given long and serious thought to the subject of faith that the present world crisis has its roots definitely in the wanton disregard for the power of faith, which is so evident everywhere. It is their belief also that there is nothing wrong with the world or with any physical normal individual now living which cannot be improved or corrected outright through the power of faith. In the presentation of this chapter, I have not been contented by merely admonishing the readers to have faith. The world has been doing this ever since the dawn of civilization, but few have made any helpful attempt to describe how one may acquire faith for the solution of the practical problems of daily life. It is the burden of this chapter to be the exception to this rule by describing and using faith. Every reader of this philosophy must use his own mind and reach his own conclusions on this profound subject. If this chapter does no more than inspire serious meditation and thought on the subject of faith, it will have rendered a priceless service, because faith is a state of mind which can be attained only through earnest self-examination, through which the individual comes into a better understanding of the inner workings of his own mind. Each individual's mind differs from all others. Every person's reaction to the experiences of life is different from that of all others. Therefore, the exact process by which any individual clears his mind of negative thoughts and thus prepares it for the inflow of infinite intelligence through the medium of faith is something that can best be determined by the individual himself. This is one thing which no person can guide another in accomplishing. I can, however, offer the suggestion that the approach to the development of that state of mind known as faith can be greatly facilitated by the stimulating influence of definiteness of purpose, backed by enthusiasm and desire, which have been fanned into a flame of obsession. Observe as you read this chapter the strong emphasis which Andrew Carnegie has given the subject of definiteness of purpose, backed by action. No desire can become and remain intense without action back of it. Chapter 1. Applied Faith. With this chapter, I approach a subject which Andrew Carnegie described as the dynamo of the entire philosophy. By this he meant that applied faith is the power that gives to those who use it an effective way to put the philosophy of American achievement into action. In this chapter, Mr. Carnegie begins his analysis of applied faith by describing its application in the development of self-reliance, without which quality no one would benefit greatly by the other chapters of this book. As far back as the records of civilization are available, there is evidence that the philosophers, the psychologists, and the scientists have recognized the existence of a power available to mankind known as faith, and the history of civilization is replete with evidence that faith is an irresistible power, that it enables those who use it to rise above seemingly insurmountable obstacles. Faith is the foundation, the very central core of every great religion. And despite the fact that it is the most talked about subject in the entire field of religion, it is unquestionably the least understood of all religious subjects. Back through the ages, mankind has been admonished to have faith, but I am without access to any authentic record of a satisfactory explanation as to how that state of mind known as faith can be inspired. Through this chapter, Mr. Carnegie and I will present our views on ways and means of developing faith, accompanied by reliable evidence of the soundness of our conclusions. The analysis of the subject of faith here presented will include both the personal experience of the author and a description of my observations of others in the application of faith as a usable force in the solution of the individual problems of life. The analysis will draw attention to the difference between faith and confidence. It will include a definite, workable formula through which that form of confidence known as self-confidence can be vitalized with the greater power of faith, and thus made irresistible. In his description of his own method of applying faith, Andrew Carnegie reveals, for the first time as far as is known, the secret of his astounding achievements, and in so doing he offers every reader a dependable approach to the understanding and use of the power of faith. Obviously, no form of application of faith is as helpful to an individual as that which aids in the development of self-reliance, for it is no mere expression of poetic words when we say, "That which man can believe, man can achieve." There is a certain state of mind which, as all who have experienced it know, serves to inspire one with enthusiasm, initiative, imagination, and definiteness of purpose to rise above ordinary difficulties and carry his plans through to success without effective opposition. We refer to this state of mind as self-reliance, but if we examine carefully those occasions on which it serves best, we will discover that it has a quality far superior to mere confidence in self. The chapter begins with an analysis of self-confidence, precisely as Andrew Carnegie explained his understanding of this subject to his student, Napoleon Hill, upon our meeting in Mr. Carnegie's study in 1908. "Mr. Carnegie, you have inspired me to undertake a job that may require the better portion of my life. The task is one that calls for self-confidence far greater than I possess. Therefore, I want you to tell me how I can develop the faith necessary to carry me over the obstacles with which I will likely meet during my research."
"You have asked me a question that should be of keen interest to every person who aims at achievement above mediocrity, and my answer will describe perhaps the most important of the 17 principles of achievement. You may put it down as applied faith. and you should emphasize it as one factor of human achievement, which gives power to all who apply it. It is the great equalizing force which truly makes all men equal.
Am I to understand you to say, Mr. Carnegie, that all men are born equal? Do you mean that men who have great self-reliance are born with that trait?
Now let me get you straightened out on this vital point before you make the same mistake that so many others have made by assuming that individuals who achieve outstanding success are born with some peculiar quality of genius not possessed by others. Self-confidence is a state of mind that is under the control of the individual, and it is not an inborn trait possessed by some and lacking in others. There are varying degrees of self-confidence, the reason for which I will explain later. Supreme self-confidence is based upon faith in infinite intelligence, and you may be certain that no one ever attains this state of mind without having first established contact with and a definite belief in infinite intelligence. The starting point in the development of self-confidence is definiteness of purpose. That is why this principle is given first place in the philosophy of individual achievement by me and many others. It is a well-known fact that the man who knows exactly what he wants, has a definite plan for getting it, and is actually engaged in carrying out that plan, has no difficulty in believing his ability to succeed. It is equally well known that the man of indecision, the fellow who flounders around and procrastinates, soon loses confidence in his own ability and winds up doing nothing. There is nothing difficult to understand about this.
But what happens when one knows what he wants, has a plan for getting it, puts his plan into operation, and meets with failure? Doesn't failure destroy self-confidence?
Now that is the very question I hoped you would ask. It gives me an opportunity to set you right on a common mistake that many people make. Failure has one peculiar benefit that is deserving of emphasis, and it is the fact that every failure carries with it, in the circumstance of the failure itself, the seed of an equivalent advantage. Examine the records of the truly great leaders in all walks of life, and you will discover that their success is in exact proportion to their mastery of failures. Life has a way of developing strength and wisdom in individuals through temporary defeat and failure, and do not overlook the fact that there is no such reality as a permanent failure until an experience has been accepted as such. The power of the mind is so great that it has no limitations other than those which individuals set up in their own minds. The power that removes all limitations from the mind is faith, and the source of all faith is belief in infinite intelligence. Once you understand this truth, you will not need to worry about self-confidence, for you will possess it in abundance. Every great philosopher has reminded us of this truth.
But, Mr. Carnegie, most people are not experienced philosophers, and they are not going to believe that every failure carries with it the seed of an equivalent advantage when failure overtakes them, as it must overtake everyone at one time or another. Now, what I want to know is this. What is one going to do when he meets with failure and the experience destroys his confidence in himself? To whom does such a person turn for aid in the restoration of confidence in himself?
You have propounded what may at first appear to be a question that is very difficult to answer, but the appearance is deceiving, as I shall explain. Let me answer you briefly in this way. The best way to guard against being overcome by failure is to discipline the mind to meet failure before it arrives. This can be best accomplished by forming habits that enable one to take full possession of his mind and use it for the attainment of definite ends on all occasions, from the smallest to the greatest daily task. I know what your next question will be, so I will ask and answer it. You want to know how one may take full possession of his own mind. The answer to this question is the burden of this entire philosophy, as no one may take complete possession of his mind until he assimilates and puts into action all the principles of this philosophy. The starting point, as I have stated, is the adoption of a definite major purpose. The second step consists of the formation of a mastermind alliance. The third step consists of a form of mental discipline, which we have designated as applied faith, the details of which we are now analyzing. Faith is the power that gives effectiveness to the other principles, and it is a state of mind that anyone can develop and use. Before beginning the analysis of the formula through which faith is acquired, let me remind you that there is a law known as the law of harmonious attraction, through the operation of which like attracts like. With the aid of this law, the successful man either consciously or unconsciously makes his own mind success conscious by vitalizing it with a keen desire for the achievement of the object of his major purpose. It is a known fact that men of great achievement form the habit of making an obsession of their definite major purpose, some well-known illustrations of which I will mention later.
How does one go about the development of that state of mind which you mention as an obsession, Mr. Carnegie?
It is accomplished by adopting a definite purpose or plan and backing it with a burning desire for its realization. Here the habit of repetition of thought comes into action. The habit may be developed by making the object of one's plan or purpose the dominating thought of the mind. If the desire back of the plan or purpose is strong enough, it will have the effect of calling into the mind a picture of the object of the purpose, and of dwelling upon that picture at all times when the mind is not occupied with less important subjects. This is the way that all obsessions are developed. The more one thinks and talks of an idea or plan, the nearer it comes to being an obsession. Here, the mastermind roundtable discussions become powerful factors in vitalizing one's mind with the necessary obsessional quality. You have heard it said that a man comes finally to believe anything he repeats often, even though it is a falsehood. Well, this is true. The principle of repetition is the medium through which one may fan his desires into a burning flame of intensity. Any thought that is expressed orally and continuously repeated from day to day through mastermind discussions and otherwise will be taken over by the subconscious mind eventually and carried out to its logical conclusion. All great leaders who make life pay on their own terms through what the world commonly calls success do so by giving orders to their own minds in the manner I have suggested. The mind can take and carry out orders, just as if it were a person, and it will act first upon one's dominating thoughts, whether or not they are given as direct orders. Thoughts of limitation and poverty will be carried out to their logical conclusion, which is poverty. The subconscious mind acts on one's thoughts without trying to modify or change their nature in the least. Moreover, it acts automatically, whether or not one is conscious of this action.
If I understand you clearly, Mr. Carnegie, one can develop self-confidence by thinking in terms of what one desires to do and can do, and by excluding thoughts of the difficulties one may encounter carrying out one's plans. Is that correct?
You have the idea precisely. While I was working as a laborer, I heard a fellow say, "I hate poverty, and I will not endure it." He is still doing day labor, and lucky to have a job. You see, he fixed his mind on poverty, and that is what his subconscious mind gave him. It would have been different if he had said, "I enjoy riches and shall earn and receive them." It would have helped, too, if he had gone still one step further and described what sort of service he intended to give in return for the riches he desired. Make no mistake about this fact. The mind brings the physical equivalent of that which it dwells upon, brings it by the shortest, most economical, and practical means available, by using every opportunity to achieve the object of one's desires. When two or more people join the forces of their minds together and work harmoniously for the attainment of a definite purpose, they attain the object of that purpose much more quickly than they could if they worked independently. When the leaders in a business organization begin to think, talk, and act together in a spirit of harmony, they generally get that which they seek. It is true that people can talk and think themselves into anything they desire. Thoughts are things, and powerful things at that. They are more powerful when they are expressed in the words of an individual who knows exactly what he wants, and more powerful still when they are expressed in the words of a group of people who think, speak, and act together.
I believe I follow your reasoning, Mr. Carnegie, and it seems sound. From what you have said, I understand that when the people of a community or a nation begin to think and act together in connection with any definite objective, they soon find ways and means of attaining it. Is that your belief?
That is not only my belief, but it is a fact. If the newspapers begin to publish stories about wars, and the people begin to think and talk of war in their daily conversations, they soon find themselves at war. People get that which their minds dwell upon, and this applies to a group or a community or a nation of people the same as to an individual. One reason why we Americans are the richest and the freest people in the world, perhaps this is the only reason, is the fact that we think and talk and act in terms of freedom and riches. Our nation was literally born of our desire for liberty. Our history books are filled with the spirit of liberty. We have talked of liberty so much that we have it in abundance. We shall cease to have it if we stop talking and thinking about it. If you want to find an illustration of how people get that about which they think and talk, go back to the history of this country and study the events that led up to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Here you will discover something that most students of history overlook entirely. Namely, the real source of the power that enabled George Washington's armies to win over vastly superior and better equipped armies. The power of which I speak is the power that began in the form of a definite purpose in the minds of a few men. It extended itself through the mastermind relationships of these men until it gave this country the liberty and freedom we now enjoy. It can be traced definitely to John Hancock, Samuel Adams, and Richard Henry Lee. These three men communicated freely, mostly by correspondence, expressing their views and hopes regarding the freedom of the colonies. From this practice, Samuel Adams conceived the idea that a mutual exchange of letters between the prominent people of the 13 colonies might help to bring about the coordination of efforts so badly needed in connection with the solution of their problems. Accordingly, a committee of correspondence was organized. Observe that this move provided the way for increasing the power of the mastermind alliance of the three men by adding to it men from all the colonies. Observe also that these three men did not content themselves by merely writing letters, but they kept up the agitation by correspondence until it led finally to the historic meeting in Independence Hall in Philadelphia, at which 56 men signed their names to the document that was destined to give birth to a new nation, the Declaration of Independence. They were motivated by an act of faith. But before this meeting took place, Samuel Adams and John Hancock hurriedly called a secret meeting of their close friends for the purpose of taking appropriate steps to translate their definite purpose into terms of action. After the meeting had been called to order, Samuel Adams locked the door, placed the key in his pocket, and calmly told those present that it was imperative that a Congress of the colonists be organized, and informed them that no man would be permitted to leave the room until the decision for such a Congress had been agreed upon. Here is more evidence of the power of active faith. Through the influence of Hancock and Adams, the others present were induced to agree that, through the Correspondence Committee, arrangements would be made for a meeting of the First Continental Congress to be held in Philadelphia on September 5, 1774, almost 2 years before the actual signing of the Declaration of Independence. Remember this date, and remember the two determined men who brought it about. For if there had been no decision to hold a Continental Congress, there could have been no signing of the Declaration of Independence. Passive faith never would have led to this daring move. Agitation was kept up by correspondence and by secret meetings between the members of the Mastermind Alliance organized by Hancock, Adams, and Lee for almost 2 years, resulting at last in the famous meeting at Philadelphia in 1776. That meeting lasted for several days, during which 56 men, the number to which the Mastermind had by then grown, engaged in the most stupendous roundtable conversations known to modern civilization. On June 7, 1776, Richard Henry Lee recognized that the time for mere conversations had come to an end and the time for action was at hand. He arose, addressed the chair, and to the startled assembly made this motion. "Gentlemen, I make the motion that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they be absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved." Out of that motion, based on active faith, was born the world's greatest nation. Out of that motion was born the spirit that gave Washington's soldiers the power to win over seemingly insurmountable difficulties. Study carefully what had happened, and you will see that these men devoted nearly 2 years of highly concentrated effort to the preparation of their minds for the performance, through active faith, of a difficult and dangerous task. I bring this to your attention here because it is in a similar manner that all great leaders condition their minds for unusual tasks. The spirit of self-determination did not spring into being by accident. It was born in the minds of Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and Richard Henry Lee, and it was given life through action by the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence. This is how men acquire self-confidence. This is an example of the method by which faith is developed through deeds. Observe well and remember the fact that action followed the adoption of the definite purpose. Without action, plans and aims are fruitless. The three men who started America on the road to liberty and freedom made use of the self-same principles of achievement that must be used by the successful leader in business or in any other calling. And I think it no exaggeration to say that the spirit of self-determination which distinguishes the American people from all other people is but an extended portion of the same spirit that was born in the minds of men.
The students of the philosophy of individual achievement may wish to know more about the application of the principles you have described. Will you, therefore, explain exactly how you applied these principles in building the great industrial empire which you have created?
That is an excellent thought, and I will act upon it by describing what happened when I converted all my holdings into the United States Steel Corporation, as that was the crowning achievement of my career. Remember, however, that this particular transaction took place long after I had conditioned my mind on self-reliance. Although the procedure followed when I decided to consolidate all my interests in the United States Steel Corporation was substantially the same as that which one less skilled than I in the application of self-reliance would have to follow to achieve success. First, I applied the principle of definiteness of purpose by reaching a decision to consolidate all my steel industrial interests in one company and sell it. That decision required considerable thought, for it meant that if I sold out, I would give up active work in business and thereby change my entire habits of living. Second, having decided to sell, I called certain members of my mastermind group together, and we spent several weeks in analysis and discussion of the values of my properties in order that I might set a fair price for my interests. We also had to work out a plan through which to find buyers for the properties and arrange ways and means of approaching prospective buyers without placing ourselves at a great disadvantage if the buyers would know in advance that we were desirous of selling. When finally completed, the plan represented the combined efforts of all the members of my mastermind group who sat in on the discussions, and myself. And it was so devised that instead of our being placed in the position of offering our properties for sale, we would be approached by the buyers with an offer to purchase the properties. This we accomplished with very little maneuvering by arranging a dinner in New York City at which my chief mastermind aide, Charlie Schwab, and a group of Wall Street bankers whom we had chosen as prospective buyers would be guests. It was arranged for Schwab to deliver a speech in which he painted a vivid picture of the great possibilities of such a consolidation of my steel interests into one company, as we had planned. In his speech, Schwab described to the minutest detail the operating company that was afterward formed to take over the properties under the name of the United States Steel Corporation. The speech had all the earmarks of being spontaneous. As Schwab made it clear that the plan he had outlined could be carried out only by gaining my consent, and he gave no indication that he already had that. The speech made such an impression that the meeting lasted into the late hours of the night, and before Schwab left, the bankers present at the meeting, including J.P. Morgan, gained from him a promise to place the proposed plan before me and do what he could to gain my consent to it. Not until long after the deal had been closed and I'd been paid off did the bankers learn that the speech was carefully planned months in advance. Then they turned the tables and the joke was on me when they told me that if I had asked an additional $100 million for my properties, they would have paid it.
From your story, I gather the fact that your confidence in your ability to sell your properties was so great that you planned every move well in advance of your knowledge as to who the actual buyers would be. Is that correct?
Yes, every move was planned in advance, but we had a pretty good idea who our buyers would be. However, we planned this particular transaction no more carefully than we planned every business move we made in the operation of our steel industry. Faith has sounder legs to stand upon when it is backed by definite plans. Emphasize this point in the philosophy of individual achievement. Applied faith is never based on blind moves. Blind faith is something of which I know nothing. The only sort of faith I know anything about is that which is supported by some combination of facts or reasonable assumption of facts. One of the major purposes of a mastermind alliance is that of providing one with reliable knowledge upon which to build plans. With such knowledge in hand, you can readily see how easy it is to develop that state of mind known as faith.
The statement that you have just made appears not to harmonize with your earlier statement that supreme self-confidence is based on belief in infinite intelligence. If you do not recognize blind faith, and have faith only in provable facts or knowledge, how do you justify your faith in infinite intelligence, since definite knowledge on this subject is difficult?
You have made the mistake of assuming that there is no source of definite knowledge about infinite intelligence. As a matter of fact, the existence and the working principles of infinite intelligence are more easily proved than any other fact. Although I am going to offer only a few reasons why I believe this to be so. In the first place, the orderliness of all natural law and all that we know of the universe is indisputable evidence that there is back of all this a divine, universal plan, a form of intelligence far superior to that which we human beings understand. I can see this greater intelligence working in every living thing from the smallest blade of grass to man himself. I can see it in the predictable movements and positions of the stars and planets, the exact positions of which can be calculated and foretold hundreds of years in advance. I can see it in the phenomenon which brings together two small cells, each no longer than the fine point of a pin, and converts them into the marvelous machine we call man, carrying in those two small particles of energy, matter, and intelligence, a portion of the ancestral qualities of man for numberless generations backward. I can see it in the mystery that converts an acorn and a handful of soil into an oak tree, and I can see it in the matchless engineering with which the tree is so attached to the ground that it successfully defies the storms and gains its sustenance without moving from its original position on the earth. I can see it in the symmetrical patterns and the ingenious breathing system in the leaves of the oak, through which it takes from the air a portion of the food it needs for its sustenance. I can see it in the laws of physics and in chemistry, through which may be found much evidence that matter can be neither created nor destroyed, although it can be transformed from one quality to another. I can see it in the atoms in the steel I manufacture, and in the process through which metals are combined into what is known as steel. There are many theories which are not provable, but infinite intelligence is not one of them. And I may as well here tell you that I believe the power with which we think and reason is nothing other than a minute portion of infinite intelligence functioning through man's brain. It is not difficult to have faith in infinite intelligence because we are literally surrounded with an inescapable mass of evidence of the existence of this intelligence. Why, every morsel of food we eat and everything we wear is produced from the soil of the earth and placed within easy grasp of every human being through methods which no mere man can duplicate. Moreover, the intelligence through which this service to mankind is rendered is so bountiful that it provides alike for man and the animals and living creatures with lesser capacities to appropriate and use, thereby proving that infinite intelligence is also possessed of infinite wisdom. And while we are on the subject of infinite intelligence, may I not call your attention to the possibility, nay, the probability, that it was the wisdom of infinite intelligence which placed me in position to make a fortune and brought you and me together as a practical means of giving the world a workable philosophy through which men may better understand and appropriate to their own use the great bounties of every needed thing with which they have been surrounded? I wish you would give this idea some serious thought, for it is obvious that infinite intelligence works through the minds of men and uses the most practical natural media available for carrying out the plans of the Creator. Once you acquire this viewpoint, you will be better prepared to depend upon faith in carrying out the task I have assigned to you. Without such faith, your task will be difficult, if not impossible, of completion. With it, you will meet no resistance you cannot overcome. You mentioned the fact that the task I have given you calls for more self-confidence than you possess. Here, then, I am offering you a viewpoint which, if you accept it and act upon it, will provide you with a form of inspiration vastly greater than self-confidence. It will give you access to an abundance of faith with which your success is assured even before you begin your task. I sincerely hope that you will open your mind to the guidance of this faith, for the job I have asked you to undertake is one which calls for no less than 20 years of research, during which you will receive little, if any, direct compensation for your labor. Now, this calls for faith, but it also serves as a dependable test of my judgment in selecting you for the task. If I have not chosen unwisely, you will perform the task I have set for you, and the world will be richer because of your efforts, and you will ultimately be richer than you need to be for having rendered the service.
Perhaps I deserve the polite reprimand you have given me, Mr. Carnegie, but allow me to explain that my inquiring into your belief on the subject of infinite intelligence in no way indicated my lack of such belief. I merely wanted your viewpoint on the subject, in order that I may pass it on to the students of the philosophy of individual achievement. I am glad I asked the question, for I now know the source to which I shall have to turn for self-reliance, and I agree with you that it is a dependable source. I am only a young man, with limited experience in the ways of life, but I have lived long enough to recognize the vast evidence of infinite intelligence which you mention. While you were speaking, the thought was running through my mind that the human brain, with its intricate system for receiving and sending thoughts, is the greatest of all evidences of your theory that infinite intelligence is the real source of the power of thought. If this theory is correct, as I believe it to be, it is equally true that the greatest of all sources for the solution of our problems of life is that which is available through our own minds. Have I caught your viewpoint on this subject?
Yes, you have, and you have done so with remarkable rapidity. Now that you have caught up with me, I want to take you for a little trip into the inner workshop of my own mind, where you will be permitted to take inventory of the vast resources of the mind as I see them. Once you have a complete perspective of the actual service the mind performs, I believe you will never again lack the self-reliance to draw upon the forces available to you through your mind for every need of life. And I believe, too, that you will have no difficulty in opening your mind at will for the guidance of infinite intelligence when you are faced by problems you cannot solve through reliance on your own reason. These are some of the mind's vast store of riches as I view them. First, and I believe this peculiarity of the mind to be most significant, it is a known fact that the mind is the only thing over which an individual has complete control. Surely the Creator did not provide man with this astounding prerogative without thereby conveying the definite idea that it is man's greatest asset. It likewise involves a responsibility to use and develop this asset. Second only to this right to control the mind is the important and equally significant fact that the mind has been wisely provided with a conscience to guide it in the use of the vast power it carries. It is also highly significant that the mind has been carefully screened against all outside intruders through a system that makes possible the opening and closing of the mind at will. It has been cleverly provided with a gateway of approach to infinite intelligence through what is known as the subconscious mind. And this gateway has been so arranged that it cannot be opened for voluntary use except by the mind that has been first prepared by faith. However, it can be opened voluntarily by infinite intelligence when communication with man is necessary and without his consent. Man's control over his own mind relates only to his conscious mind. The mind has been provided with a faculty of imagination, wherein may be fashioned ways and means of translating hope and purpose into physical reality. Someone has said that the imagination is the workshop of the soul. Of that, I am not sure. But there is evidence that it is the workshop of the conscious mind. The mind has been provided with the stimulative capacity of desire and enthusiasm with which man's plans and purposes may be given action through the imagination. It has been provided with the power of will, through which both plan and purpose may be sustained indefinitely, thereby giving man adequate power to master fear and discouragement and opposition. It has been given the capacity for faith, through which the will and reasoning faculty can be subdued, while the entire machinery of the brain is turned over to the guiding force of infinite intelligence. Get the full significance of this fact, and you will be near to the method by which one may develop faith. The mind has been cleverly prepared through a sixth sense for direct connection with other minds under the mastermind principle, from which it may add to its own power the stimulative forces of other minds that serve so effectively at times to stimulate the imagination. It has been given the capacity to reason, through which facts and theories may be combined into hypotheses, ideas, and plans. It has been given the power of deduction, by which it may foretell the future by analysis of the past. This characteristic explains why the philosopher looks backward in order to see the future. It has been given the power to select, modify, and control the nature of its thoughts, thereby giving man the privilege of building his own character to order, and of determining what sort of thoughts shall dominate his mind. It has been provided with a marvelous filing system for receiving, recording, and recalling every thought it has expressed through what is called a memory. Moreover, this astonishing system automatically classifies and files related thoughts in such a manner that the recall of one particular thought leads to the recall or memory of its associated thoughts. It has been given the power of emotion, a feeling, through which it can stimulate the body for any desired action at will. It has been given the power to function secretly and in absolute silence, thereby ensuring privacy under all circumstances. What a power! It has an unlimited capacity to receive, organize, and store knowledge. It has the power to aid in the maintenance of the health of the physical body. And apparently, it is the main source